Hello, Phil. It's John.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Your week going okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Hey, thanks for agreeing to have a chat with me.
Oh, no worries at all.
Yeah.
Don't know how much I can help, but I'll say what I can.
Okay. Cool. I guess I was doing some research in the Northeast music scene, and I kept coming across your name and who else? Dick Godfrey and Ian Penman.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember those guys?
Oh yes, definitely. Yeah. I'm still in touch with Dick. I haven't seen Ian for about 30 years, but
right.
Dick I see quite frequently.
Okay. And I'm wondering, obviously, you said you didn't, you never met Prefab Sprout or Paddy individually, but...
Not that I recall, no.
No. Do you recall Avalon at all?
No, I don't think I do. I mean, I remember the name, but I don't remember actually meeting them.
No, that's okay. I've got a friend up in the Northeast. He was sort of involved in the music scene... As a musician, and I think he helped people do a bit of recording and mixing and so on back in those early 80s, late 70s. And he's been very good in terms of giving me a general flavour from a band's point of view. I just wondered if you could offer something from a sort of journalist's point of view. Yeah.
I made out. And one of the So we would play all sorts of stuff on there, and of course it was mainstream commercial music, but also immediately we introduced the idea of putting new band slots, local band slots on there, you know.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's how we sort of got in touch with the local music scene, in obvious mutual interest, you know. We wanted these bands to put these bands on the radio, and they wanted to be on the radio, much though it was only to a God knows how tiny local audience that we were broadcasting from 10 o'clock on Monday nights, you know. So we'd have them in where if they did a demo tape of any sort, very often at that studio in Wall's End. What was it called? Was the guy called Dave Wilson who ran it, was he?
I don't know.
There was a studio in Wall's End.
Okay.
I think it was called Impulse.
Okay, yeah.
Wouldn't swear to it. I think it was called Impulse. And I think the guy who ran it was called Dave Wilson. But again, I could be misremembering there. Sorry, my memory of names and details is very leaky. Yeah. I just always has been. I'm not going to see now just yet. So that was the mutual interest thing that started. Now, it happened to coincide very luckily with a boom in the pub rock scene in Newcastle. I wrote about some of the local bands in that year of 74 to 75 when I was first a freelance and I was writing for Sounds. And then one thing that happened to me was I got a job in London. Sounds asked me to come down and be news editor, and then something called special projects editor. So I did. I was down in London for 75 to 76, that's September to September, I think it was. It was an even year. So I missed that bit of local happening. But when I did get back there in September 76, which was partly due to my wife, who was then my girlfriend, because I'd just broken up with my first wife, I came back up to Newcastle because she was there, and got back into the same pattern of work as I was doing before. You know, I freelanced for Sounds, who were still happy for me to write for them, and worked for Radio Newcastle, sometimes for money, though not on Bedrock. And I think I wrote a column for the Northern Echo or something, and so on. Anyway, I made a living, you know, it was all right. Meanwhile, some of that living, both in 74 to 5 and then again in 76 to 9, I made out of reviewing local bands. So there was a connection there which worked quite well, which was go see a local band in pub, they might have a demo tape, so we might, if they were halfway decent, just because they were local, we'd put them on Bedrock. That was all part of just establishing a local reputation for them, which was okay. Nothing spectacular about that, you know, but it was a useful little piece of the jigsaw, I suppose. But then I also reviewed some of these bands for Sounds, a national music paper, so that was, I suppose, was potentially of far more use to them and local bands than me. Put them out there in a different setting altogether. Now, we're talking the tail end of 76, punk started to come up. It was a distant rumour to us initially that, of course, some of the bands started to come and play gigs in Newcastle. The Damned and the Clash came up and lots of others, and they started to have an influence on the local music scene. And so, my memory of it is it was already surprisingly dynamic in the sense that this pub rock scene was going. There were several venues. The Bridge Hotel was a great one, which was always there, which was traditionally a folk venue, but they had, in their upstairs room, you know, they would also have rock bands of one sort or another. What else was there? There was that pub down by the quayside, the Cooperage. They'd have bands in there, I think their upstairs room, which was an interesting room because it was alongside a staircase, and outside another staircase, steps, concrete steps that took you from the quayside up into town, so bands would come and carry their amps on these concrete. Yeah. And what else did we fly? There was a pub in on Heaton Road. I can't remember the name of it. Radcliffe Arms might just have been, but I may be completely wrong.
Okay.
Anyway, the, I remember seeing White Heat there and one or two other bands. I know Last Exit played there, Sting's band.
Yeah.
Yes, Sting was playing with Last Exit in an upstairs room in the Gosforth Inn. As distinct from the Gosforth Park Hotel, the Gosforth Inn is a little pub on the on Gosforth High Street. Sorry, just off Gosforth High Street, I think. Anyway, Last Exit played in the upstairs room there, and they had a weekly residency. I also played in the University Theatre every Sunday lunchtime. So those of us who took a shine to Last Exit, which I did, would go and see them twice a week, Wednesday at the Gosforth Inn and Sunday lunchtime at the University Theatre. You know. When I think about it, the University Theatre, they'd alternate with the big band. You know, heard of the Newcastle Big Band?
Yeah.
Run by Andy Hansen.
Right.
Notable players were, all of Last Exit were in it.
Really?
Yeah, so Sting played in the big band as well, so they blast out these spirited renderings of various things from avant-garde jazz like Return to Forever to Count Basie stuff to speciality was MacArthur Park.
Yeah?
It was a wonderful rendering of MacArthur Park they used to do. No vocals, just an orchestral.
Wow.
A big band, I should say. And you had Ronnie Pearson on drums and Sting on bass, sometimes singing when they did a song. And Jerry Richardson on keyboards from Last Exit. John Headley on guitar from Last Exit. I think it was about 15 to 20 piece, depending who showed up. Andy Hudson conducting. So that was nice. Very enjoyable. It was all very good. I must say that one name that's missing there is the Club of Go-Go, and the Club of Go-Go was shut by the time I arrived in Newcastle, and that had been a big figure in music in Newcastle in the 60s. You know about it?
I've certainly got reputation, but I don't know much about it. Yeah.
Well, the thing, I suppose, in a sense, the music history thing about it that's notable is that Sting and mates saw Jimi Hendrix there. And of course the Animals, but Jimi Hendrix, and that was a life changing thing for Sting and many others. You know, and every band that was on the circuit would come and play the Club of Go-Go. But it was shut by the time I got to Newcastle, 1969. I never went there. I think it must have been shut in 69 itself. Anyway, sorry. There was, I guess the difference is there was no club that travelling bands, the touring bands would play at. It was all either the Mayfair or the City Hall for the visiting bands. So I suppose you didn't get the lower ranking touring bands coming through. You only got the big ones, and then, which maybe left some space for the local bands. I don't know. I never really thought of that, but possibly it did.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Bedrock was rolling along. My personal contribution was writing for Sound about a lot of these local bands. I really did cover quite a few of them in the national press, you know, which is odd, and most of them didn't make it, of course, although some of the individuals from them did. One that's just popping into my mind is a fairly large band called Gale Force 10. Oh, they played in another pub in Heaton, that's where I saw them. There was a pub come hotel at the top of the dip after you go down into Jesmond Dean, and I remember seeing them play there. I forget what it's called, probably the Heaton or something. Anyway, just there's another venue, so I've already mentioned five, and there's probably more in the town, you know, which is not bad for a city centre the size of Newcastle's. They weren't really short of somewhere to play, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Gophers 10 had in them a keyboard player and saxophonist called Joy Askew. You probably never heard of her, but she became a very prominent session musician. Went to New York, and you know, you see her name on a lot of that oddly surprising albums. She never made it solo. She was quite a good singer, but she never made it solo. She played sessions as a saxophonist and keyboard player. Very unusual for a woman.
Yeah.
Fool's Tent, there you go. What else? So then the scene diversified in the sense that then we got a so-called musicians collective together.
When was this?
I imagine this was 76, 77, I'm not perfectly sure, but I think it was.
Okay.
And what were we called? We might have been named after Bedrock, or we might have had some spin-off name. But anyway, it was remarkable, really, because we would have meetings at a lunchtime once a week, or possibly it was once a month. Sounds more like it was once a month, doesn't it? And the musicians would get together, and I know Dick and I often chaired these meetings, who you know, were no kind of musicians at all. And I guess we were both among the organisers of this collective, and also we ended up chairing because we were both trade unionists.
Right.
So we were quite used to running meetings, you know.
Yeah.
We're both in the National Union of Journalists and committed to that and very active in it. So I guess Bogan was in our mid to late 20s by then.
Yeah.
That must be why we had that role. And plus, I suppose we had a certain prominence because of the radio show and the journalism, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that we and the musicians pulled that together, and for a while that I can't remember what the bloody hell we did, except I think we must have organised some gigs.
Yeah.
And we tried to sort out some problems that the musicians were having, whatever the hell they were about venues and so on, you know.
Hmm.
Just tried to see if. So there was, what I mean is that there was some kind of collective spirit there.
Yeah.
It wasn't bands at loggerheads with one another. I'm not saying the bands never had a row, but there was a nice feeling, and that's what I remember, whereby all these people who were trying to make it in some fashion, albeit if they had no higher, they said to themselves, no higher than the Newcastle scene. They were all trying hard to get their music out, you know, like every artistic person is motivated to do that, and they were.
Yeah.
Possibly a few of them had the hope of becoming stars, you know, and some of them did have star quality, but obviously very few of them would make it, but they were having a crack. And I do remember one of the older crowd who was, a couple of the older crowd were very nice and helpful as well. They were Hilton Valentine from the Animals joined it,
right. The
collective, and also the Junko Partners did.
Right.
If you've ever heard of
yeah,
them.
Yeah.
J-U-N-C-O, that is.
Yes.
I can see their leader, their singer, and I can't remember his name. Very nice fellow.
I think there were a couple of compilation albums.
Dick had a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
There was, Andy Hudson put out a Newcastle Big Band album, and Dick got together with the guy from Impulse Studios in Wall's End,
yeah.
Wilson, I think. And he really organised, I may have been peripherally involved, but it was certainly mainly Dick, plus whichever musicians, did the compilation album, which was called Bedrock.
Yeah.
So that was, so to speak, branded with the radio show, you know.
So was it...
Still got it.
You've got it, have you?
I have, yes.
Yeah. I guess, was that tied in with the BBC?
No. Nothing to do with the BBC, except they gave us airtime, you know.
Yeah.
Free. We nobody had to pay for that show. Nobody got paid by the show.
Right.
It was just the bosses of the local radio station said, yeah, you do a show if you want, Dick. And so he did, you know, for several years.
Yeah, yeah.
It was wonderful having the liberty of the airwaves as we did.
I believe also you wrote for Out Now.
Yes, Out Now. There was another diversion or whatever that we got into was the fanzine, you know, was the era of the fanzine.
Yeah.
But that was founded by two local teachers.
Yeah.
I think they were both teachers, possibly only one, but anyway, I believe they were teachers, and I can remember their names mercifully, I think. One was definitely called Tom Noble. And the other, I think, was called Hugh Jones. I'm less sure about him, but I think he was called Hugh Jones, blonde bearded guy. And Tom Noble was a tall, scrawny, curly haired guy with glasses. And Nathan founded Out Now. they came to us at Bedrock, which was, I should say that Bedrock was kind of knee-deep, and then the museum was involved, and a guy called, I think, Arthur Hills, not Eric. He was also involved and would come along and do interviews and pitch in and so on. And another lad called Scott Massey. Frazier Massey, one of those two things. I think maybe it was Frazier Massey, who went on to be a journalist for life, as far as I know. I haven't seen him for years, but I think he went on to be a journalist. Yeah. Ian Pengman was a teacher as well. But he used to write a bit about the local bands. There was me taking all the credit, and he wanted to break into journalism, and he did write for about some of the local bands, I believe for NME. Could have been NM, but I think it was NME he wrote for. Mm. And so he had two guys, certainly. I don't think there are any others, but I think there's at least the two of us writing about those local bands for the National Weekly Music Papers, you know, which had very big circulations back then. It's absolutely their heyday. So it was stimulated by punk. NME went up to 250,000 circulation, I think, in the late 70s, and Sounds went up to about 200,000 in the late 70s. So that was on the back of punk. Not that either mag was exclusive to those, but that really got things going. So, yeah. And people wanted to read about punk. Of course, that's a crucial thing about the connection between any music phase and the magazines. It's, what is this, the kind of music people want to read about? Sometimes they just want to dance to it. But punk, people want to read about it. It's a very global medium. So that was all taking off, you know. So the local bands were a real mixture of punk and new wave, and the old punk bands, you know, including prog rock, heavy metal, whatever like to call it, South Band. They were kind of Southern Boogie Band in Newcastle, you know, so not supposed to happen, but of course they just loved the organs and whatnot, and they played in that style. It was Beckett, of course, they were big at time, except they were on the way down, kind of, by then. But they were knocking around, but still giving it a go. The punks were they're really interesting punks, with Penetration, who half made it. They got to make two albums with Pauline Murray. They were from, I think, Ferry Hill in County Durham, Pintle. So that started to happen, you know. It spread out to beyond the metropolis, where I guess most of these bands lived originally. And then it spread out. So you got Ferry Hill, there's Penetration. That's middle class kids, really, who came into town and made some very good records off them. Actually, Fred Purse is still around in Newcastle. I think Pauline may be back in Newcastle and possibly even running a studio these days. She was last time I saw her, which was about 5 years ago. What else? Then there was Neon, fantastically intelligent bunch of guys who I loved.
Yeah.
Who made a few records that never made it at all.
I'm in touch with
a guy called Tim Jones. Yeah. In the Lake District now.
I'm in touch with Tim. Yeah, he's been helping me as well.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah, a real nice guy.
Lovely and a terrific band.
Yeah.
Paddy Addison on drums and Mark Dunn on bass. There, I can remember the whole lineup. Amazing.
Well, you know, in 1980, he recorded an album with Prefab Sprouts drummer at the time.
With who?
With Prefab Sprouts drummer.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know it was Prefab Sprouts drummer.
Yeah, so there you go.
It was extraordinary. They were real new wave, I suppose. They played very, very fast and quirky, witty kind of songs. My favourite was I'm a Gent, at Your Convenience. It was a fine song. And then again, in a whole other area of punk, of course, with the Angelic Upstarts, he became the most notorious band in the area, of course. And this all happened 76, 77, although Angelic Upstarts had a very long life and indeed may yet be out there again in some revived form, I believe.
Yeah.
But they were a fantastic event, Angelic Upstarts were, and they gave me lots of good copy. I mean, I wrote features about stepping up, you know. I wrote features about Penetration and about Angelic Upstarts and also about Punishment of Luxury. They're another new wave band, a completely different area, because they came out of a group. So they were older, they were middle class, and very theatrical in their presentations.
Is that Brian Bond?
Brian Bond, yes. Whose real name is Brian Ratkin. Another luxury. And a little fellow called Jimmy, who played guitar, I think, also. Or perhaps he played drums. Maybe there's four of them. Anyway, I managed to get a feature on them in Sounds as well, but they had a couple of albums out on UA, perhaps, United Artists. Might have been, I'm not sure. Penetration had a couple of albums out on Virgin, ventured towards the big time. Angelic Upstarts probably had six or seven albums out over the years. They were signed with Warner at one stage. They started off, of course, with that single, Who Killed Little Towers, which was a... You know about Little Towers?
No, no.
That was a coast celeb of the times. They were from Jarrow. I think Little Towers was killed in Durham, I believe. I stand to be corrected on this, but he was... L-I-double-D-L-E, I think his first name is Phil. He was a working class guy who staggered home drunk one night, got arrested. Clearly he was beaten up by police and he died. I don't think anyone was ever prosecuted for it. But Angelic Upstarts did a song about this, what happened to him. Yeah. Who Killed Little Towers, I believe it was called, which was raging fast punk. They had Mency out front, who was this terrifying figure of... he'd been down the mines, you know, he was a proper punk, in the way that a lot of southern punks were a bit militant about him. Well, Mency came out of the mines, and a very fascinating, contradictory background. He dropped out of grammar school in order to go down the mines. He was a very intelligent lad, but social mores meant that he was completely unable to stay at grammar school because that's where the posh kids were. So he left and he rebelled. I think he got himself expelled actually rather than left, and went down the mines, although he couldn't stay down there long because he had chest trouble. But anyway, so he came out of the mines and into punk. Like I dare say Fury would say you were supposed to, you know, but almost nobody did do that sort of thing. And so they had this wild, wild following. They were dangerous, they were very violent. I interviewed them a lot, and we were able to talk about it. But they had a manager called Keith Mills, who'd just come out of Durham jail. If I remember him right, and I'd hate to libel him, he'd done 2 years for a fray, which is an interesting archaic word, which means...
fighting.
Something very violent anyway.
Yeah.
And the band were they were skinhead punks and had a terrific really good drummer, I forget his name, and a really good driving guitarist called Martin Cowley. So they made a really good noise, you know, they made very good punk records. Nancy got the singer got very political, much like, I mean, you could say that was a political start in one way, but he got sort of analytical political later, and he ended up making sort of themes of praise to for Scargill during the miners' strike and that kind of thing. But one huge crisis which I was heavily involved in, which was definitely to do with the Bedrock Cooperative, was in the Newcastle Festival, which was run by Andy Hudson of the Big Band. They had a night of local bands down at the Guildhall by the quayside, and me and one or two of the, or possibly the whole Bedrock gang, we decided to put on this sort of pub new wave night. I think we had four different nights, and they were all different types of bands, you know, so you'd have a pub rock night and a whatever night, prog rock, whatever. But we had a punk night, and the lineup was Neon topping the bill because they seemed to be the biggest thing in Newcastle at the time. Then Angelic Upstarts, and then, not sure, wasn't Penetration. Anyway, Angelic Upstarts fans enjoyed their band and then expressed their resentment for Angelic Upstarts not being top of the bill by smashing the place out. The Neon were absolutely terrified, quite understandably. They being good middle class boys. I believe I did get to play, but I don't know how. It was absolutely, as one of the organizers, and I was on the bill at the gig, so I was right there. I really had one of those tight nights when you think, what the fucking hell have I unleashed, you know? But it wasn't the last word from the angelic upstarts, although they did have one or two more terrifying nights. Nancy was a person in transition, which is one of the amazing things you see in creative work sometimes, is that people really work through a lot of issues, I suppose, is the jargon word these days, about their lives, and Nancy changed a lot, and the angelic upstarts moved out of Newcastle.
Yeah.
As I recall, partly for getting a record deal, but partly because Nancy knew he had to leave those fans behind.
Yeah.
And because he didn't want to be a part of what they represented, which was wild and random and uncontrolled violence as a recreation, like it is for some people. And Nancy had led that, had inspired it. He'd taken part in it, and he realized what it was, and he didn't want any more of it. So that was a fairly substantial reason, as I recall and understand it, for them moving away.
Yeah.
Probably in 78 or something like that, I'm not perfectly sure at all. But that was their little story in Newcastle. It was one of the more dramatic stories that happened there.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I suppose the biggest story was Sting, actually, in the midst of all that, you know. Playing his own furrow, he more or less did, because, well, whilst I suppose you could say he was part of pub rock and Last Exit, whilst it was a jazz rocky form of pub rock, and they played a huge repertoire of stuff from soul greats like Bill Withers and B.B. King and Fleetwood Mac. I need your love so bad, that's what I call it, the salsa. That's what they used to cover with Fleetwood Mac. Over to Bill Withers, and then they'd go over to the jazz end and return to Forever and Mother Report on Sunday. They could make perfectly respectable shots at that.
Am I right in saying it was Dick Godfrey's matchmaking that brought Police together?
Police? No. It was me.
Oh, it was you? Right. I knew I'd read something. I don't want to miscredit anyone.
No, can't do that.
Tell me the story.
I will. I'd have got there. My one contribution to rock heritage. Yes, I think we're playing away. And then punk, end of 76, comes up, right? And so there's an evening when, in December 76, Curve Deer played Newcastle Polytechnic. And I knew Curve Deer quite well, particularly Sonny Christina. Reviewed them for sounds and so on, you know. So I went backstage afterwards, and there was this interesting scene which had its symbolic value, although it was also just sheer rudeness. But the social secretary was telling them that they weren't worth £1,000 that they were to be paid for the night. Don't know who he was, but anyway, that was his view. And I think they gave him a mouthful, but they weren't feeling too cheery, and you know, the gig had been good and it had gone down well, so I don't know why the social secretary was being as obnoxious, so obnoxious. So I said to Sonia and Stuart, okay, to cheer you up for the evening, how about coming to, there's a gig on up at, I think it was Northumberland Teachers Training College out in, probably out that way, somewhere out that way, Denton, I'm not quite sure where it was. And there's a party too, but anyway, the important thing was that there was the gig and at this teacher training college, which was Last Exit, who I really loved. They were a wonderful band. I wrote a feature about them for Sounds as well.
Right.
But anyway, that didn't work. So Stuart saw them, and given the awareness that Curve Deer's time was up, so to speak, and all that kind of band, that they were in trouble, and not just because of punk, but they were having a hard time making a go of it, kind of thing. He was looking at Sting, and he already had in his mind, he told me later, to start a punk band. And so when he looked at Sting, he didn't see, oh, that's a nice band. I'll introduce them to my manager of my record label. What he was thinking is, I'll steal Sting from this band if he'll come with me down to London and play punk. And so just after Christmas, when he'd kind of firmed this up idea up, he rang me at Gaylene, and that's my wife, Agatha, the flat that I shared with Gaylene. And in some fashion, I put him in touch with Sting, gave him the phone number or whatever. And he then invited Sting to come down. There was a period when Last Exit and the initial phase of the Police were running alongside one another. I don't know what would have happened, but Sting always says, well, I went to London with Last Exit, but actually Jerry was the only person that came down. The other guys could not root themselves. They were 10 years older. They were in their 30s rather than their mid-20s. It was all to do with that, you know.
Yeah.
Roots and wives and maybe children even, whatever.
Right.
Anyway, they didn't come down. So at a certain point, Sting decided to cast his lot with Stuart Copeland,
yeah,
give this punk thing, which he hated, the music, a go, and went down with his wife, Frances Tumblety, and their new baby, just born. All of that, an extraordinary gamble, you know, absolutely extraordinary gamble. Left his teaching job, of course, because he had a day job then.
It was around that time, I guess, you know, all the fanzines were starting to come out. I mentioned one, I think, in an email, Helter Skelter.
Oh, yeah, I don't remember that. Doesn't mean anything. I just don't remember it myself.
Okay, do you remember any others at the time?
I honestly don't.
Yeah.
I expect I was wrapped up in Out Now, you know, which...
Yeah.
I lost track on that, didn't I? Yeah, Hugh and Tom started it, and then I wanted to broaden the base of people who work for them, I suppose. So eventually, we became another of these collectives or cooperatives or whatever you like to call it, you know. We all pitched in some money. It was probably about 20 quid each then to make a substantial contribution, you know. And became a partnership in Out Now, which, but Tom and Hugh made the editors. They were in charge, definitely. Throughout, and I don't know, we ran about 15 issues, but it's interesting to look back at it, because to me it was the fanzine as Proto-Q magazine, I mean, you know. It was quite a posh affair. It was they were teachers, they were proper, they wanted to make a good magazine as opposed to one that was full of chopped up stuff and headlines made of bits of newspapers.
Yeah, exactly.
it was very untypical of the fanzine. What it was typical of, I suppose, was people in their late 30s, like we all were then. Late 20s, I should say. I might have been the oldest one. I was 30 in 1977, so I might have been the oldest one amongst them. Oh, Dick was that age too. And so we all know. We all pitched in together, and it was very nice. I still got some copies of that too, you know. It was my style, so to
Yeah.
But I'm sure the other fanzines were punk zines and so on. That's why I missed it, because it wasn't my thing, really.
Yeah.
Obviously wrote about punk in all sorts of ways, but I wasn't a punk and couldn't be.
Right.
Tried not to pretend.
I just, one of the things I'm particularly keen on doing is trying to find source some photographs of some of the old venues. Or maybe some of the bands playing in some of the old venues. And I wonder who you used for photographs back then.
Well, the only photographer I remember is Rick Walton, and I've just put his name into Google, and I'm now looking at, he's in Donegal now, R-I-K-W-A-L-T-O-N, Rick Walton.
Yeah.
A list of rock musicians. Well, he hasn't got a list of venues. He's got a list of the rockers whose pictures he took in Newcastle, mostly. Mostly they would be in Newcastle.
Did you ever see George Madison?
George Madison? I don't think so, no. I don't remember that name.
The Carpets.
Oh, the Carpets, I probably did then.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't remember his name.
Yeah.
Apologies. There's a local band, local heavy metal band called Raven. They were the number one heavy metal band in the area, Raven. The famous of Pantang, you remember that?
Yes, I went to see him a couple of times,
There you are, Sunderland, I think, with the heavy metal band again.
Yeah.
He's got some good stuff. He's got more than he'll have on his website as well.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad I asked that question, actually, because, getting some decent photographs of the time is... It's often, especially if you live quite a distance away from the scene.
Yeah.
It can be quite difficult. But,
sure. Well, Rick... I don't know how much Rick has kept of his back catalogue, of course, but most photographers are pretty devout about that.
Yeah.
So there's a fair chance he'll have an array of pictures of all the obscure bands, that nobody ever heard of outside Newcastle.
Yeah, okay.
He was certainly around taking shots of them, just like I was around, watching the bands and reviewing some of them and so on.
Sure.
Taking shots for Out Now magazine, of course. So that's another possible shot. Source of pictures is Out Now magazine.
I guess we were discussing sort of chronologically there, and we got up to about 78, I guess. Tim and Marshall, two guys I've been speaking with, they've been telling me about the massive pub scene where there were literally hundreds of bands in the area. And but obviously that died out, and maybe around the early 80s. What do you think it was that changed in the music scene?
I've got to say, I truly don't know.
Yeah.
Because that was kind of the time when I left, because I left in March 1979.
Yeah.
I came down to London again. I am a Londoner, but I came down to London again to freelance, but travelling with Gailey, who we eventually married. And we set up in London, and I was able to write for Sounds again, and The Face and Smash Hits and so on, through all the magazines ever since, kind of thing. But I don't recall, at the time I left, March 79, I don't recall an awareness that the Newcastle scene was collapsing.
Mm.
I may be misremembering that, or I may have had rose-coloured glasses on at the time, but I don't remember thinking, oh, this is a dead scene now, so I'm off. There's nothing like that, there's other things happening in my life that made me move. And as I say, I just don't have the recollection that...
It wasn't so much that, it was more, nationally the music scene sort of changed. The university gigs became more popular, and then after that, larger venues and so on, I guess from my... recollections. I was born in 1960.
Yeah.
But, I remember I had a paper round. I was 14 years old, and I had enough pocket money to go and see a couple of bands at the weekend.
Yeah.
It was cheap. There were bands from all over the UK playing in dozens of venues, and
yes.
And it just sort of seemingly stopped. I don't know if it was to do with promotions and getting back. I don't know.
No, I certainly don't. I mean, the music was lively for a long time. Mm. One movement blended into another, you know, punk, new wave, new romantic. It kept on multiplying through to the mid-80s, as far as I recall, in terms of British music.
Yeah.
You know, you were never short of a new movement. Well, disco on the side and all that, you know.
Mm.
So, I'm not quite sure what would have happened there. Perhaps it was economic. I think of 79, that's the year that Thatcher came in. So she came in following the Winter of Discontent. I moved south at the end of the Winter of Discontent. You remember that?
Yeah.
So the economy was in a big downturn at the time. Unemployment rose to very high figures. I just put unemployment figures 1980 into Google here, and what came up was BBC on this day, 1982 actually, UK unemployment tops 3 million. You know, UK unemployment yesterday fell to something like 2,450,000. So we know we're in upshit creek at the moment. However, in at least unemployment terms, things were worse then. 3,070,000 in 1982, and I believe it got a bit worse before it got better. Mrs. Thatcher was frequently heckled as she insisted there were encouraging signs the economy was improving. There were 32 people chasing every vacancy, said Labour leader Michael Foot. So she was, you know, bottoming out in the polls because of all these economic reasons.
Yeah.
Until the Falklands War came along in 1982, I think it was.
As you say, the different waves of musical styles and genres, so to speak, coming and going, flowing, and ebbing and flowing, but it seemed to sort of go very quiet after the mid-80s for a period of time. That was just my impression, but...
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Manchester came up at the end of the 80s, didn't it?
Yeah.
Perhaps there'd been a bit of a slowing down there. Although, in a sense, I suppose you could say it was sort of papered over by the fact that in the mid-80s, the bands that were big became bigger than any bands had ever been before.
Yeah.
In terms of record sales, in terms of live audiences, because that's really when stadium rock got going. I mean, there'd been gigs in stadiums in the 70s. From the early 70s, really.
I guess Live Aid may have kicked that off.
Live Aid is said to have had a big influence, isn't it? Mm. And that was 1985.
Yes.
Which sort of celebrated stadium rock and
exactly. Yeah, across the waters as well.
Well, of course there was the CDs came out. The CDs really started in '84 and took off in '85.
That's right.
So that was a commercial effect, is what I mean. You know, it didn't exactly affect the music, but it had a commercial effect.
Yeah, very true. Very true, and MTV and so on.
Yes, and also in the marketplace it kind of encouraged retrospection as well, because people were buying albums they'd got on vinyl over again, weren't
That's
they?
That's very so true, yeah.
Brought older people back into the record shops, as far as that goes, which possibly brought older people back into watching gigs as well, you know.
Yeah.
And the ones that perhaps with the Beatles generation like me, going back to gigs and so on. Maybe that kind of thing. I'm not sure why the Newcastle and the live venues and the plethora of local bands, you know, why that should have stopped. I don't have any clear explanation for that at all.
Now, I believe also I was reading somewhere that you've been quite active in terms of speaking up for freelance journalists' rights.
Yes, that's true.
Well, tell me about that.
All right, okay. Well, it's through being a trade unionist, you know, and being a freelancer. I've been a journalist for, I started on the Chrome in the end of 1969, did my apprenticeship there, you know, so I've been a journalist for 42 years in September, I think it is, and I've been a freelance for 33 of those years in total. And so you put that together, you know, the self-employment, because freelance means self-employed, with being a committed trade unionist, and you have this weird situation of being an organizer, which obviously has parallels in the bedrock scene in Newcastle, you know, but it's you can find yourself an organizer amongst self-employed, possibly unusually individualistic people, a bit like musicians are, you might say, in a way, you know, not entirely at all, but a bit, and kind of creative, although I'm not in the same artistic way that musicians can be, and so it's that, and that's what I've followed through the last 30 odd years, you know, and it mainly, well, there was a big strike at Sounds in 1981 that I was involved in, where I sort of helped to organise the freelance side of the strike. That's unusual in itself, of course, self-employed people striking, but once in a while we do. Started, in fact, as in support of the staff, which is the most common way the freelance journalists strike, is you come out in support of the staff, like they will be doing at the BBC tomorrow, all over the country, and but then, you know, sometimes you end up, very occasionally you end up doing it on your own, and we did at Sounds for a while. The staff went back after their strike and we stayed out, and just I was one of the organisers there. That was about money, basically. And we did get more money than the staff, so that was useful. I imagine the increases back then, the staff got a 7% increase, and we got, on various rates, we got increases of between 11 and 14%.
Wow.
It'd be startling today, wouldn't it? But inflation was fantastically high. If you look at inflation figures back in those days, again, you know, the, in terms of the statistical background to anything that's going off in the music scene, inflation would have been up towards 10% at that time, I'm sure, possibly more. In the great early days of Maggie Thatcher, partly she'd inherited that from Labour. So I just worked away with it down the years, and more recently, I suppose the other aspect of it that I'd say is that more recently, and again there's certain parallels with the way musicians are, I've been heavily involved in defending freelance copyright. Because the working for, often as a freelance individual, you often are working for an enormous corporation that runs loads of magazines, you know. And they come up with these all rights contracts. They want you to sign away copyright in your work. And you'd rather prefer not to, and so you get scraps and campaigns, and so we had a big one in 1995 at Q and Mojo, and that was owned by a company called EMAP, East Midlands Allied Press, where I was again one of the organisers of the freelance resistance, and that really was a big success. It's about the most satisfying industrial scrap I've been involved in my life. We defended our copyright, we established negotiation rights with the company, and we were on very good terms with them for another 15 years after that, because they'd, in a sense, said, oh, we were wrong after all, okay, let's do a deal. And we carried on doing deals for, on rights and money for the next 15 years. And then, but EMAP were bought by a German magazine company called Bauer, Bauer Media, in 2008. And after a period of assessing the situation, last year Bauer piled in to, with the sort of contract that EMAP had hit us with in 1995, Bauer hit us with those contracts again in 2010. And we had another scrap, and we didn't, we achieved a few
Yeah.
And, you know, they're all the time threatening, sign this contract, oh, you'll never work for us again.
Right.
It's very brutal. And so some people did, and some people got better contracts, and blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I haven't signed away my copyright. And I won't, but Mojo gave me a non-copyright signing contract, so after the fight was over, individually I accepted that because it was okay, you know.
Yeah.
Collected scrap was over, but it's a bad situation. And so Mojo, Q and Kerrang are now owned by the most aggressive copyright grabbing magazine publisher in the UK, Bauer Media.
I appreciate your time, Phil, and I've enjoyed having a chat with you, and like I say, I really appreciate your time on this.
Oh, you're welcome.
And when...
If I come up with anything else, or any contacts or whatever, I will.
Okay.
And mostly I've lost those old contacts, you know,
yeah.
But if I can help at all, then I will.
Well, you've not done bad remembering names and places, I have to say.
Oh, some of them I do, yeah, I surprise myself.
Okay. Thanks again, and enjoy the rest of the evening.
Okie dokie.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.